When I was 20, all I wanted to do was farm as many acres as possible. I want to minimize that. I would love, my goal with this system is that if we could devise a system where 80 acres is, you know, a common denominator of land in Iowa, and if you could raise a family on 80 acres, what we have is we have a 30-foot strip, a wide, 12 rows wide of corn growing next to a 20-foot wide strip of pasture. And within the pasture strip, we created a mobile barn that is on wheels and is able to be advanced with four different species of livestock, give people an opportunity to flip themselves from somebody producing just commodities to somebody producing things that would have the ability to capture a higher amount of margin for the farmer rather than passing things down through the chain and being left with just kind of the breadcrumbs, which I think is what a lot of us out here are left fighting for.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, all across the country, some people are wishing they could farm. Some people that are farming are saying there must be some better ways. And a lot of farmers are facing challenges. And you find some creativity all over the place. And we're going to talk about creativity taking place in north central Iowa this morning. And I'm happy to welcome Zach Smith. Zach, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you very much for having me. Glad to be here.
So, Zach, let's place you. So I've gotten down Buffalo Center, Iowa, and that doesn't really kind of jump in mind right away. I don't know. Where is that exactly?
So our claim to fame is that we were the first consolidated school district west of the Mississippi. So that's our notable point, I guess, for our small town. We're located basically directly due north of Des Moines, about 10 miles south of the Iowa-Minnesota border.
Oh, okay. So if I wanted to go there, I could choose between flying into Minneapolis or fly into Des Moines, go to one and go south, to go the other one and go north, right?
Yeah, it's actually about the same distance either way. And if people are familiar in the Midwest, especially with Interstate 35, we're about 40 miles west of Interstate 35.
So I assume you're there because you grew up somewhere near there. Is that the case?
Yes. So I grew up in Buffalo Center, correct?
Okay. And then did you go away sometime and come back, or have you been there as you've grown up and stayed there?
So I grew up there. I went to Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa, after I graduated high school in 1998 and attended school there through 2002, and got my degree in agronomy and had a lot of really great life experiences in Ames, and had some other extracurricular activities that got me introduced to a lot of different types of people and ways of life while I was there. And but I decided, when I came out of college, the ag job market was pretty dried up. The price of corn had not taken off with the ethanol boom yet, and so the job market was pretty tough. And I ended up coming back here in 2003 and getting a job for a local farm operation. And, that was, So I went away for 4 years, had a lot of great experiences, and ended back up in Winnebago County after that, and been here ever since.
So, well, how did you get yourself into a farm? Did you rent it, buy it, borrow it? You know, how did you go from transitioning back and have your own farm to operate?
Yeah, so to be clear, when I came back, I worked for another family's operation for the first 2 years, and I was just a farm manager. And so I did that for just a couple years. My family has farmed here since the early 1900s in this area. And when I came back, there was not room for me with my father's operation, especially given the economic times of the late 90s, early 2000s. So I started off working for somebody else, and from that point on, I went into a job in agricultural retail, I guess you would describe it as, selling crop protection products for about the next 10 years. And within that 10 years, my dad decided to retire, and which opened up an opportunity for me to step in and take over the family operation. And so I did that in 2014 and have been farming basically on the side of either the other jobs or now the business that I own and operate. My farm operation is something that I do at night or on the weekends, essentially, while I operate my other businesses during the day.
So, and your other businesses are related to farming as well?
Yes. So I am a seed dealer, crop protection dealer. I do crop consulting work around farm nutrients and recommendations on those types of products and soil sampling. And I sell cover crops and have some custom seeding for cover crops available to people as well. So a lot of irons in the fire.
Well, you know, that seems to be a key for people that are in agriculture these days. For one reason or another, people have to do several different things anymore. I don't know what it takes to be a full-time only doing farming to prosper, but at low grain prices and everything, it's thousands of acres, I'm guessing, to be able to just support a family with only a farm income.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, for my operation, I only operate about 300 acres. And at least from a commodity standpoint, if you're raising commodities, it's virtually impossible to feed a family on 300 acres if you want to have any type of standard of living, especially right now with what's happened over the last few years here. But, you know, if I always kind of said if I was to farm on my own, you know, I would definitely want to have somewhere between, you know, 1,500 to 2,000 acres to, you know, probably feel confident in being able to have a chance to take care of my family with, you know, that type
no,
of
and family. even those size operations, I know, like soybeans, you had the trade issues in the last year or so and lost the Chinese market and all the issues with soybeans. And then with corn, I think, as you're saying, I think corn is going into ethanol and feed for animals, and then you've got, you know, the other uses for it, which are more, you know, manufactured products and so forth with corn. But but ethanol is not very good right now, I understand.
No, it's terrible. The plant that I've had has been shut down since I think it was March or April, and they declared force majeure on some of my contracts due to COVID. And some of the other circumstances around things. So, it's really kind of threw a monkey wrench into the whole situation. You know, recently, you know, the grains have come back a little bit, but we're far from anywhere near prosperity at current levels. Yeah. So a lot of uneasy people in the agricultural community right now about the commodity markets.
Well, and then if you add the ethanol, well, the ethanol, somebody else pointed out to me the other day, the other thing that's affecting is when you have people not flying anywhere and you're not driving much anywhere, I mean, that has an effect on the ethanol market. And then you've got trade issues that are affecting some of the others. And then you've got livestock's not has had lots of issues, certainly mm-hmm. with the processing plants and not necessarily getting all the hogs through the plants and so forth. So, I mean, that's a triple whammy on the corn soybeans world. And the, you know, the other thing that you often hear from the Midwest is that the people that are just saying, in fact, maybe you use this term, it's kind of a race to the bottom in a way. I mean, it's people double down and saying, well, what I do is corn soybeans and, you know, what choices do we have? And yet past experience on that, recent experience is not very good. I would imagine you're not the only one scratching their head and saying there must be something better or I've got to make these enterprises a little bit more profitable. But you actually came up with something to try that's different.
Yeah, we did. And it basically came about for exactly what you just, you know, kind of expounded upon. We were my partner and another individual and I were brainstorming or have been brainstorming for the last few years as the crunch has been on margins, especially in the last probably 3 or 4 years on things to try to find an alternative where we could, being smaller producers, we could find a creative advantage around the economic conundrum, I guess, so to speak. And it was that want and need to evolve that led to this idea that we came up with in February of this year called stock cropping. You know, essentially what that system is trying to accomplish is to kind of flip the commodity, or at least for people that are interested, give people an opportunity to flip themselves from somebody producing just commodities to somebody producing things that would have the ability to capture a higher amount of margin for the farmer rather than passing things down through the chain and being left with just kind of the breadcrumbs, which I think is what a lot of us out here are left fighting for right now. I've just kind of become tired of it. I know there's got to be another solution, and the nice thing with our system is it kind of addresses a lot of the criticisms or challenges that maybe folks that aren't familiar with agriculture have toward agriculture.
Again, I think across much of the Midwest, I've heard a lot of feedback, people saying that they're trying to find right size again. They wish they've been, you know, going through a stage where they have to get themselves up to the 1,500, 2,000 more acres, fight for any land that comes available, that you try to lease more or buy the anything adjacent, certainly. And even beyond that, to people now that are having to put their equipment on trucks and go across the county to try to put together whatever they think they need to survive. And I've heard of other people saying, this is crazy. Hold on here. Let's figure out a way that we just don't have to try to keep chasing, getting bigger, bigger, bigger in scale to do the same old thing. There must be other ways. So I hear you saying that there is another way. And I think there's a lot of other people who are going to be paying attention to you. I imagine you hear about from people that are saying, it's interesting what you're doing, how you're doing it, because maybe we want to try it as well.
It's been a crazy 6 months. If you would have told us back in February and March, when we had this whole thing on a marker board, that by the end of the summer, we would be doing podcasts and have newspaper articles and field day, and people kind of following us from around the world. It's I don't think we would have believed you. We've definitely struck a chord. You know what that means? I'm not sure yet, but it's been a fun summer, and I'm glad the idea is at least resonating where people are interested, and they hopefully think that maybe it does have some validity to further be developed.
You know, I kind of put the cart ahead of the horse here, and we ought to say what it is. You set aside some an acre or so and started in a concentrated way trying a system of combining crops and livestock. Could you explain that?
Yeah, so what stock cropping is, it's essentially the intersection of livestock and row crops, at least in this instance, happening in the field at the same time. So the way, you know, for folks that aren't familiar with a lot of things are produced out here in the Midwest, you know, we're very specialized. In Iowa, it's usually, you know, typically you have a field of corn, or you have a field of soybeans, or you have a hog, you know, a confinement site, or you have a cattle feedlot. And folks are pretty specialized in what they do. There's some people that are somewhat integrated, but things are kind of kept separate. And there's criticisms around how those things are done. And we thought, well, could we devise a way to leverage row crops with livestock and achieve some efficiencies from an economic and potentially an ecological slash environmental standpoint to kind of leverage livestock and crops off of each other. And we've got some really cool synergies that we have working with, you know, where the animals produce. So basically, I should back up and say, so what we have is we have strips, a 30-foot strip wide, 12 rows wide of corn growing next to a 20-foot wide strip of pasture. And within the pasture strip, we created a mobile barn that is on wheels and is able to be advanced with four different species of livestock contained in that mobile barn. So we have sheep and goats out front. We have hogs behind them, and then, you know, trailing in the back, we have chickens and chicken tractors that are kind of our cleanup animals in the past. So we're producing four different species of livestock. We've got all that different biodiversity from their animal manure, from their, you know, the microbiome and their gut getting put into the soil. We're growing, you know, potentially one of the feedstuffs that we could harvest this fall and feed back to these animals the next year. And that's really what we're trying to drive for, is build a complete cyclical system that allows the farmer to retain more value rather than shifting those things off the farm, and giving the farmer, I think, a very attractive story to market the meat from that system to consumers who are interested in people producing animal meats in that fashion.
You know, I have to get a picture of this again. So if we look at your farm, we'd see these strips. We'd see, I mean, you still haven't picked corn yet. So you've got these rows of corn and then the pasture, is it a perennials?
This year, it's just an annual mix. And the reason that it's annual is because the following year, we will switch the strips and put the corn where the animal manure, you know, was laid the previous, where the barn went. And then, you know, vice versa, we'll put the animals where the corn was, you know, the previous year.
Well, you know, this is really unique. I mean, I've seen a lot of farming systems, and I've seen systems that have sheep and cattle in the same pasture, and I've seen chickens sometimes mixed a little bit. And there was a time, even back in your country, where you used to put hogs in the feedlot with the cattle feedlot, and some of the shell corn that was fed would, you know, too gross for some people, but it kind of passes through. And so you'd see kind of pigs and cattle in the same area. But this sort of an orderly moving it through, it's really different. It's, as you know, I mean, it's been around for a few years, like Joel Salatin and some others have done it with chickens. But I've never heard of anybody doing this rotation through the fields, you know, multi-species like you're doing.
Yeah. So, you know, Joel Salatin, everybody recognizes, is kind of one of the godfathers of this space. I mean, what he's done with Polyface Farms is incredible. And when we were, I really started watching a lot of his videos on YouTube. And it wasn't before this idea, but when I was really getting interested into it, I started watching a lot of his stuff and realized really quickly we had a lot of things in common. But the key differentiator between with what he's doing with a lot of his really intense and really intelligent pasture, rotational pasture stuff is, at least I don't think he's, you know, growing the feedstuffs to feed the pigs and the chickens, at least on his farm. That has to come from somewhere else. And so that's the unique thing for us, is that we are trying to basically produce the entire ecological system, everything that needs to take with the land, the feedstuff crops, and the ability to, you know, make and grind our own feed on the farm, and retain as much of those things that when you specialize, you farm those things out. And when you farm those things out, you lose potential money in your pocket as a farmer. These are things that 50, 60, 100 years ago, people used to do all the time. And what we are doing is we're not trying to go back in time. We're trying to use some of these older principles when we didn't have some of the technologies that came about in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s when kind of the industrial agricultural complex set up shop. We're trying to maybe go back to some of those, but apply some of the new technologies, especially, you know, when it comes to our mobile barn. You know, we're fully intending on trying to make that an autonomous moving barn with solar panels and electric drive systems and things that we wouldn't had at our disposal. So kind of mending the best of the natural world and some of the new technologies we have available to us in 2020 with this system.
Are these on wheels, or is it like sleds that you have to hook a tractor and pull?
No, they're on, the current model that we produced is on three wheels, two wheels where most of the weight sits, and then there's a pivoting wheel so that we have the ability to steer, manually steer the barn through the strip as we move it.
Wow, that's impressive. Now, a question. I mean, you studied agronomy at Iowa State. So are you testing the soil and seeing what you're accomplishing with the soil?
Yeah, so we have not done it yet, but I will be going over and doing some baseline stuff either today or tomorrow ahead of our field day that we're having for next Thursday. And because I am really interested, and I've had a lot of other people express interest in wanting to get some baseline studies on, you know, what the initial implications are for what we're doing and how it's impacting you know, the soil that we're putting on right now.
You know, I just heard a presentation that was at the Agriculture Showcase and Innovation, and somebody was looking at the effects on the microbiome. And when they start looking at the microbial life in the soil, they're starting to find that in plots and areas, there are some areas that because of the microbial life, they need zero nitrogen. And that's kind of interesting. I mean, if what I understood them, you could get back to your strips of corn, and there may be some areas yet, possibly, imagine farming today if you didn't have to apply any nitrogen at all because you've created this really, really incredible microbial life that for some reason is helping the plants get by without additional nitrogen.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And, you know, when we had the prairies, you know, hundreds of years ago here in Iowa, we weren't putting anhydrous ammonia or other forms of nitrogen on to make them 12 feet tall. They figured out how to do it on their own. There's a lot of things actually in the industrial ag complex now where they're trying to sell, you know, some of these biological products that do exactly what you just said, fix their own nitrogen in a jug. And, you know, those are options and those technologies have been developed too. But I think that there's a lot of things that can come from free just by putting animals in a unique fashion back out on the land and incorporating, you know, some of the natural principles of agroecology to try to do some of that on its own. It doesn't mean that, you know, we're not purists in this thing. It doesn't mean that I'm not going to use nitrogen fertilizer because I still need to grow, you know, the feed stuff to satisfy the animal need. But if we can reduce that, we're putting less of those inputs on, and there's a ton of, not only for farmers' economic interests, but water quality standpoint in Iowa and a lot of other carbon footprint, all of that stuff, a lot of potential benefits, I think, that we will hopefully find with this system. You got to remember, like, when we had this drawn on a whiteboard, we had no idea if this was going to work at all. And so we've learned a ton in the last 3 months, and we've got a lot more to learn, but you know, those details will get honed in closer and will be better, especially when we network with more people. You know, that's the fun thing. And there's been so many great people that have reached out and contributed ideas. And because we're definitely not experts, I'm not a livestock guy, you know, per se, I'm a crops guy. But I'm very much willing to learn and excited to network with people to help us make this a better system.
So now I want to get to the other hard part. So you get this livestock, and it's hard to find any place to get livestock slaughtered anymore. So how are you solving that problem of finding a place to process the meat?
Yeah, so initially, I guess just to back up, part of the thing that got me into this is for the last 10 years, I've, on the side as kind of a hobby with friends and family, I've raised my own pork and chicken that we have butchered ourselves and actually with our pigs. The chickens I've just done on my own, and they're relatively easy to got any access to stuff. You know, on the farm, space and time, those are easy. The pigs, we've kind of started a communal event, started back with just two or three people and two or three pigs in 2011. And it's kind of morphed into this annual tradition in end of November, first part of December. A bunch of us gather and we get a pig and we spend 3 days having a meat communion, so to speak, of getting together and slaughtering and learning the skills of butchering and packaging. And it's really been an influential thing for this idea because I've seen so many people are so disconnected, especially where meat comes from. And when you introduce, whether it's even in people in ag, there's a lot of farmers that have never butchered an animal before. Yeah. And so we have farmers that participate. We have urban folks that participate. And it's just kind of a magical thing that happens. And so you're right. One of the biggest problems, one of the biggest things that we have to solve is figuring out the processing piece because it's difficult for small sized places to get enough butcher slots. You know, to be available, especially now with the whole COVID thing. So I think, honestly, if our idea is to take off and scale, there are going to be several other things that have to take off and scale with us. And if those things don't scale, then we will have to find creative solutions to perhaps maybe get the consumer more involved with actually processing animals themselves. And that's an idea that I think could have a lot of really fun creative paths to get there for people that are willing to or have that interest in participating in that type of an experience with their food.
Actually, I've been to some places back in Pennsylvania where people are coming from out of the city and take title to the livestock and have a facility to slaughter it themselves. And it's not the same restrictions for, you know, USDA and state inspections, so that they do it themselves. It seems good the way they're doing it, but that's how they've kind of gotten around it, is that they've learned to do some of their own processing. And but they're also close to like New York and Philadelphia, and you're not. I mean, you've got two good cities, good sized cities. You got Des Moines a couple hours south, and you've got Minneapolis a couple hours north. But you're not just outside of a huge metro area where you're.
Yeah, that's correct. And I've thought about that and looked at, you know, if this thing was to scale, does it make sense to keep it here centrally located where I've got plenty of access to land? You know, we've got Sioux Falls, you know, to the west of us as well, about the same distance. Or does it make sense to, you know, to do the production closer to where the people are? You know, we're not to that point yet. You know, we're still very much in the, you know, this is our proof of concept here, but you need to be where the people are. And people that, especially the market that would be interested in what we're doing.
Well, it's interesting. They've got a local food policy programs down in Los Angeles, and they've defined local food as 200 miles. And so, you know, if you were part of the 200 mile circle, you hit a lot of population though, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I think one thing that kind of system that you're describing, seems like, if you make it work, You ought to be able to drop a couple acres, you know, outside Kansas City or Indianapolis or a lot of other areas that people can intensely produce livestock and plants into a small acreage. It really should be able to be almost anywhere in the country, close to where there is an in market.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the goal that, you know, when I was 20, all I wanted to do was farm as many acres as possible. And now I just turned, you know, 41, and I want to minimize that. I would love, my goal with this system is that if we could devise a system where, you know, 80 acres is, you know, a common denominator of land in Iowa. And if you could raise a family on 80 acres, what that would mean, you know, for community development, where adding more, you know, young producers, giving them a route to access with, you know, good cash flows and access to markets and things like that. I mean, there's just a lot of things potentially that could come from a system like this if you were able to make it viable and get the things around it to support it to make it go.
Well, and then you get to use a lot smaller tractor when you're doing 80 acres too, especially with your kind of system.
Yeah.
You're not going to go spend $600,000 or $1 million on a combine or anything.
Yeah, you know, the John Deere released their new X9 combine here, you know, a month ago or whenever that was, and I look at that and look at the simplicity of what it, you know, you could have probably less than $50,000 worth of equipment easily, and you know, versus $1 million, and you know, hopefully have a pathway to feed your family. So.
Well, I think that's really. It's really exciting. And, you know, around the country, one thing I've noticed is that, especially on the plant side, you know, I grew up thinking too, that everybody was heading to having several thousands of acres, but I am running across people that are making a living on 3 or 4 acres of land.
Mm-hmm.
And they work harder than I want to work.
Yeah.
but they can do it, you know, and
yeah, if you're growing the right value crop and you're willing to put in the work and the time and the effort, that's really easy. And that's why, you know, our system is not going to be something that's going to be flooded with people, because it, you know, quite honestly, it will require a lot more work, and it will be more intensive. But that's kind of the way farming used to be. And farming has kind of evolved into this push, easy button, you know, thing where one of my guys that I've followed for a lot of years in a presentation last winter, you know, if we have nothing left but easy tasks to perform, why are we surprised that we have little value at the end of the day, something to that extent. And, you know, with a lot of things with how we raise our commodities, it's, you know, it's the rise of autonomous stuff, taking in, making decisions for us. You know, it's no wonder to me why we don't have a lot of value left, or stake or skin in the game at the end of it, with the way things have kind of evolved. So.
The other kind of interesting thing I'm seeing happening too is that we now scale is going both directions. You know, it used to be that scale, and we talked about equipment and technology, was all for bigger, getting having access to it. And we're getting more and more things that allow you to keep track of what your soil needs and animals need and all that with operated off your smartphone. You know, small tractors that are working in odd-shaped lots and fields and so forth. And so it's finally kind of turning the corner and finding technology available and artificial intelligence and all sorts of things down to being able to be utilized by, you know, smaller scales of farming.
Yeah, I guess I want to be clear. Like, I'm not against, like I said, I want to use the best of technology, but it's still going to be difficult to replace a farmer if you're having these complex systems. And that's one of my goals. I'd like to be able to find a way where it's tougher to be replaced. I think in the commodity game, it's going to be very, very easy eventually to be replaced by an X9 combine, or, you know, have operations replaced by that. And one of the goals out of doing this is I'm tired of seeing kind of the desertification of the towns in the Midwest because we're losing our farming population. When I graduated high school, probably half the kids came from farm families that I graduate with. My kids, they'll graduate in a couple of years. They're about the same class size, but there's less than probably a handful of kids that are coming off of an active farm operation. So that's one of the goals, is that if we can, you know, do something to slow or lessen that trend, that would be a good thing from the system as well.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny. I bet there may be more of those kids that graduated with your girls that will be interested in farming someday than maybe graduated with you, because I'm surprised how many people that had no farm background at all around the country are saying that's what I really like to do. They'd like to be able to work outside, work in the nature, and there's enthusiasm. But they're going to have to feed the family and make enough money that they don't have to have so many off-farm jobs to support it, to be sure it's transitioning from a hobby to a significant share of income. Maybe not 100% income for a while. So I would imagine people are going to start asking you, maybe they have already, to share with them what a financial statement would look like, or a business plan. That saying, okay, here's what I'm putting into it, and here's what I'm getting out of it. Are you having to answer those kind of questions?
Yeah, we've started that process, and I talked about that 80 acre kind of schematic. It's kind of the goal, and we do have something built out around that type of size, which I think would be relatively accessible to do. And we put together some cash flows, making some assumptions based off of the stocking rates that we've kind of started with, and they may have to be amended, for some things here. But and I've shown them to several different folks, including some bankers and groups like Practical Farmers of Iowa, and just ask them to take a look at the numbers and see what they think. And the feedback I've gotten at this point has been extremely positive from that standpoint. But like I said, the biggest thing that this thing hinges on is being able to find a path to processing, because I think it would be easy to scale the system, but you have to have a place to go with the animals and a way to get those to the end user in an affordable fashion. And that's going to be, I think we've jumped the first hurdle right now, or I've gotten close to it anyway with our first stab at this. We're going to have some tweaking to do, but that's got to be the focus moving forward, is developing the processing and the marketing.
Well, I think it's the biggest problem all over the country, processing, and there's got to be some, they got to either loosen up the rules and regulations and make it easier for local slaughter to take place again, because I hear too many cases of somebody starting to grow their own chickens and having to drive 200 miles to slaughter the chickens if they're not doing themselves. And in the case of the sheep, there's like 3 packing plants, I think, west of the Mississippi River for lamb slaughter. And so it really is, I think, one of the biggest obstacles.
It absolutely is. And I think it's going to take more than somebody like me or any individual. It's going to have to take, some big collective action from the powers that be, that you know, look, especially what happened with the COVID situation and or what could happen with any, you know, other national emergency, you know, around food production and the implications of how we would fare in something like that with having everything as concentrated as we have right now.
Well, you know, and yet there's a local market. I saw in the same story that had you featured, they were talking about how in Iowa alone that there's a potential market of, gosh, it's something like nearly $1 billion of demand that would take local food if they could get it. And there's kind of the assumption a big share of it or realize that maybe it's going to be a little more costly than typical commodity, but there's a lot of people that would still buy it if it was available to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the other comments I've gotten from a lot of folks that have, and it's not just the meat raised in our system, but if, you know, you've had animals that have been raised outside versus stuff that have come out some of the confined units. I mean, I've talked to even owners of hog confinements that have said, made the comment to me, I would much rather consume for my family something that was raised on dirt versus on concrete. And because it does it, there's a difference in the taste, you know, in the meat and the, I don't know how to describe it other than that. And until people are given A versus B, you know, it's hard for them to be aware of what some of those things are. They're just used to going to the supermarket and that's the only way they ever purchase meat. So.
Well, you need to be like they were in some of the good old days when the pork producers used to go to the supermarkets and pass out samples of pork on a toothpick. And and I think it's almost back to those sorts of things, too, that people get a chance. And they do get that when they go to farmers markets and some others. Well, it's interesting. Let me just wrap up. If you look ahead over the next 4 or 5 years, are you optimistic?
Yeah, I am. And the reaction that we've gotten from people has far exceeded my expectations. I feel like we've hit a nerve. Does it mean we have it figured out? No. But I'm a lot more excited about this than, and I'm a lot more enthusiastic and optimistic about the potential for the future and the continuation of my family's farm operation with something like this that has, you know, more value, hopefully for us at the end of the day, than hoping that my ethanol plant opens back up so that I have a close and competitive bid for my number two yellow corn. So, yeah, so I guess I'm optimistic cautiously, but I'm excited for the challenge and I welcome the things that are going to be hard that we're going to have to overcome to try to push this forward.
So, Zach, if somebody's listening to this and they want to know more about the kind of thing that you're doing and they're thinking about doing it themselves, what do you suggest?
Well, if you want to follow along what we're doing, we're pretty much on all the social media platforms. That's probably the best way to follow us. So if you go to YouTube and search Stock Cropper or The Stock Cropper, and stock is spelled S-T-O-C-K, just like livestock. So we're on YouTube. We are on Instagram with the_stock_cropper. We're on Facebook, where we also, one of the big things we didn't talk about is transparency of our system. So every night we do a Facebook live stream where we have a camera mounted on our barn so that you can see the animals and what they're up to and how they're doing every night. So if you search The Stock Cropper on Facebook, you can like our page and follow along with that stuff. I think either this week or next, we're launching our website, which is thestockcropper.com. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, that's where I do a lot of my instant communication. My handle is at Zebulous Prime, and Zebulous is spelled Z-E-B-U-L-O-U-S, and then P-R-I-M-E. And those would be all of our handles online.
Well, Zach Smith, I tell you, I'm encouraged by what you're doing. I'm kind of amazed. I haven't heard of others doing much of that before. It's really an interesting progression on some of the things that are being done around the country. And I think you have a lot to offer other people. They're going to look at the same idea. And I just want to thank you for taking the time to share this with me on Farm to Table Talk.
Yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity. And it was a great conversation.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.